people think of COVID as causing, lots of death, and it did. But everyone infected with HIV, until we had treatment, everyone infected with HIV died of the disease, 100%, or nearly 100%.
This is Meaningful Medicine. In a challenging and unpredictable world with high burnout rates, this is a podcast where incredible individuals share their most meaningful patient experiences and focus on those moments of positivity and joy that sparked their love of healthcare and changed the way they practice medicine.
Hi, I'm Nicole Hohenstein, and I'm an emergency medicine resident at UCSF.
Hi, I'm Shiva Kayambashi. I'm a doctor and professor of family and community medicine at UCSF.
We're the co-hosts of Meaningful Medicine. We created this podcast to highlight stories of healthcare professionals who have found a sense of meaning, resilience, and joy in their work.
Hi, Shiva. How are you doing?
Hi, Nicole. I'm doing great today. I am really, truly, and sincerely excited about our guest and our topic that we're speaking about today, about the early days of the HIV epidemic. I'm very excited about it. How are you today, Nicole?
I am doing very well. I know this has definitely been one of these passion topics that we've been trying to schedule for a while now, and I'm so, so, so excited about our guest and really discussing the early days of the HIV epidemic, especially because we all just lived through the COVID pandemic. So really having both of those in mind as we discuss this important topic today.
We're really excited to have our special guest, Dr. Paul Voeperding, who's just an amazing physician and leader and researcher and teacher. And he's just been such a pioneer and somebody who's really helped the HIV epidemic in the early days and beyond for the next 30 and 40 years. So I think we're both super excited. I know I am. And Nicole, you have some experience working in Ward 86, which is the outpatient HIV clinic in San Francisco General Hospital. Am I correct?
Yes, I was lucky enough to actually, like day one of medical school, be assigned to be able to work and actually implement a QI project at Ward 86. And I must say, the patients, the staff, the physicians there are just absolutely fabulous. And it's very palpable to see their passion for just their patient population. And it really is inspiring and such a wonderful place for me to learn medicine.
Absolutely, Nicole. What an amazing experience for you. And for me, I mean, my entire career after residency has been at San Francisco General Hospital, and Ward 86 is so integral to the care of our patients across the board. I mean, the early days and currently still, that was just really the model of outpatient HIV care from the time when we didn't even have medications to treat it. And now we have so much success in treating our patients and keeping them alive and healthy. That was really unimaginable 40 something years ago. I remember I was just starting college roughly when the HIV epidemic started, and it was terrifying. And I remember my dad was the chief of the chemistry division at the lab at San Francisco General. And that was even in the early days, we didn't even have testing for it. We didn't really know what was going on. And Nicole, I'm not sure if our listeners are aware, but prior to the HIV epidemic, we didn't have universal precautions of wearing gloves for everything. My dad was reminding me that phlebotomists would go around with bare hands and draw blood. That was routine up until around 1985 when we knew what we were dealing with. And one of my dear friends who's a nurse early in those days, she reminded me that the nurses would go around to the different wards and they would change dressings, bloody dressings with body fluids with their bare hands, again, until we started with HIV. So HIV really changed medicine in so many different ways.
I'm so excited to be able to talk about HIV, and a lot of us know about HIV, but I think it's been years or decades since we really talked about the statistics. So I wanted to first take a look back. It's been over 40 years since the start of this terrible epidemic, and really, I think it's important to look back at what was life like and what were the statistics when there were no tests and when there were no treatments for these patients.
Right, Nicole. And you and I have been talking about this for a while, and we were discussing a great article that was put out by the World Health Organization. It's called Why the HIV Epidemic is Not Over. And from that article, it stated that since the early 80s, when the first AIDS patients were identified, the medical community initially knew really very little to nothing about it. And when these initial cases of illness and really severe advanced illness were seen, they didn't know about the disease. It didn't really have an agreed upon name. And we didn't know how it was spread. There were no tests or treatments. And by the time most patients presented with symptoms, they had only months left to live. They had very advanced, and these were diseases that we really never saw before, like pneumocystis pneumonia, that just didn't happen before, and Kaposi sarcoma, just didn't see it before. It just didn't have anything agreed upon. We didn't know the cause. We just knew it was a terrible disease, and we knew that in the early days, they were mostly gay men that were affected by it.
It's wild to think, and a lot of my mentors who I work with were starting either residency or early attendinghood when the HIV epidemic hit, much like my colleagues who are residents starting their residency when the COVID epidemic hit. So really, it's an interesting thing to think about, and I think it's important in the U.S., this illness was really first seen in a lot of marginalized communities, mostly in gay men, people inject drugs, or people exchange sex for money. So there was a lot of need for the community to advocate, to push for research, to push for money, and to push for people to spend time looking into this illness because the mass public wasn't necessarily getting these first infections. It was really these marginalized communities. And this took years. The first antiretroviral medication called AZT didn't come out until 1987. And it was only a single drug and had some short-term benefits. And then it took another 10 years. At the 11th International AIDS Conference in Vancouver in 1996, the highly active antiretroviral treatment known as HART, it was effective, and the combination of these three antiretrovirals were reported to reduce AIDS-related deaths between 60 and 80%. So truly revolutionary. But it took us 15 years to get there.
Yeah, right. And during that time, so many people died. You know, Nicole, according to the World Health Organization, since the beginning of the epidemic, more than 70 million people have acquired HIV infection, and about 35 million people have died. And today, around 37 million people are living with HIV. And of those people globally, only about 22 million, a little more than half, are on treatment. And that still remains a problem globally, right?
I think it's really exciting to think about. I think there's been a transition, at least in the past 5 years, if not past 10 years, where HIV is now looked at as a chronic illness rather than a really life-shortening and deadly illness. And looking at today, we now have accessible testing for HIV treatment. We actually now have preventative options known as pre-exposure prophylaxis, also known as PrEP. And we also have a bunch of services available, specifically in the US, but you know, globally growing, to reach out and have access to our vulnerable communities. Although there, as I mentioned, there's much work that needs to be done still in the US and globally.
Yeah, Nicole. And you know, the topic of HIV, I think we're both San Franciscans, it hits really close to home for us. Some of the first cases of HIV in the world were discovered in San Francisco. And in particular, this relates to our special guest today. It's really a very unique moment. In July of 1981, on his first day working as faculty at San Francisco General Hospital, his first day, Dr. Paul Volberding encountered a young man, a 22-year-old patient, with cancer. It was an unusual cancer that was spread across his body and especially evident on skin. It's called disseminated Kaposi sarcoma. And he had severe wasting. He was really skin and bones. And it was this very patient who would become known as one of the first AIDS patients. And this patient was reported in the New York Times and then in the CDC's publication, which was called the MMWR, the Morbidity Mortality Weekly Report. And soon after, it was discovered that AIDS, acquired immune deficiency syndrome, and these advanced cancers like Kaposi sarcoma were caused by a virus, human immune deficiency virus. It was initially called HTLV-3 before they knew to call it human immune deficiency virus. And in 1983, UCSF faculty physicians, prompted by a lot of the wonderful staff who were working with patients, opened the country's first outpatient AIDS clinic, which is, we were talking about it, it's Ward 86. And that was done in January of 83. And then an inpatient AIDS ward, which was called 5B, there's a wonderful film documentary made about that called 5B, was then opened in July of that same year at San Francisco General Hospital.
Thanks so much for sharing that, Shiva. It's truly an amazing story. And the history of the HIV epidemic cannot be talked about without talking about Dr. Paul Wolberding and the amazing physicians, nurses, and researchers at UCSF and San Francisco General Hospital. And really, truly talking about all of the community of San Francisco coming together to advocate for these patients. So enough of us talking this wonderful man up. We will jump into this introduction. It is a pleasure and an honor to introduce Dr. Paul Wolberding to our podcast today. He is a highly accomplished, world-recognized, and very loved UCSF Professor Emeritus of Medicine. And as previously mentioned, he is a pioneer and leader in care of patients with HIV, and we are incredibly honored to have him with us today. Welcome, Dr. Wolberding.
Oh, the honor is mine, really. It's great to be here, and it's hard to sit and listen to nice things being said about one, but I look forward to talking to you.
They're very much deserved, Dr. Wolberding. We're really so grateful to have you here. And before we get started, we always like to ask our guests at the beginning of our interview, if you could, in short, talk to us about a very meaningful experience in your early life or in your training that was just especially defining or transformative or formative for you.
Oh, there are so many. I think any physician, any healthcare provider, in the course of deciding to go into healthcare and training, has these moments. I think maybe one of the most important ones for me was when I was an internal medicine resident at the University of Utah, and this is before the AIDS epidemic by a few years. I had a patient who was a very fundamentalist Christian person and pastor who had an absolutely horrible, incurable malignancy. And because he and his wife had such a strong personal belief in the power of healing, she really couldn't have him talk about the fact that he knew he was dying. And so when she wasn't in the room, he was able to talk to me. And I thought, boy, as a young, barely trained physician, I'm being brought into this complicated family situation, and what an honor it was to be able to talk honestly with him about what he knew he was facing. And I think more than anything else, that made me decide to really go into clinical oncology, to care of cancer patients, because it just made such an impact on me.
Thank you so much for sharing that really difficult situation. And I love that when you're faced with a really complicated social situation, your first reaction is, wow, I'm honored. So that just shows that you are definitely in the right field. I wanted to ask, when you and your colleagues first encountered patients with advanced stage AIDS, what was it like to not know what was causing the illness and how it spread? And were you at all concerned about how this could affect possibly your own health and safety?
Oh, there's about an hour response to that question. You know, we go through medicine, you know, we study, we learn about the history of the illnesses that we treat, and we see it as usually quite incremental. We know this about hypertension today. Tomorrow we'll learn a little bit more. Our treatments will get a little bit better. And that's the way we sort of expect this to go. But nothing prepares us. Nothing prepared me to, at the end of my training, when I was supposedly knew everything there was to know about cancer, to walk onto the wards that very first day at San Francisco General Hospital and see a disease that I'd never seen before, presenting in a patient that shouldn't have had the disease and suffering from something else that was going on because he was so sick, more than this cancer, which was usually thought of as a skin cancer, should have made him. So right from the very first moment, this was obviously something new. At least it was new to me. And I think that all of us as healthcare providers had that experience, you know, where we suddenly, our eyes were open, we knew something new was happening, and we had no idea what it was. I know some people had more of an instinct to think that this was a viral infection right from the start. I didn't certainly have that wisdom. I saw this as a very unusual cancer, a very unusual aggressive cancer in a surprising situation of a 22-year-old man. And certainly nothing made me or other people think that we were at any risk for getting this. We weren't used to catching cancer from our patients. And so our eyes were pretty well blinded to what would happen in the future and to what we'd be seeing. The fear came later as we began over the years to suspect that this was an infection. But at first, it was just very surprising, very shocking, but not one of a fear personally at that point yet.
And Dr. Volperty, I'm just thinking now, because now I'm just putting it all together. In 1981, when you saw that young man with the severe Kaposi sarcoma, which you knew was a cancer and you weren't thinking of it being infectious in origin, up until 1985, roughly, when we identified the virus and understood this was truly infectious, for those 4 years, were you, as clinicians who were caring for patients with these syndromes that we didn't fully understand at all, were you protected in any way? Like, were you wearing any kinds of personal wear? Because again, prior to this, no one was wearing gloves or anything. Tell us a little bit about that, those years.
Sure. And over time, over the first couple of years of dealing with these patients, the realization that this was probably an infectious disease did grow. You know, the patients had not just cancer, but these variety of infections, strange, we called them opportunistic infections, because they had only been seen in people whose immune systems were very severely knocked out from something. And so really from the very early days, we knew that there was something going on with the immune system in our patients. And at the end of 1982, Art Ammann, who is a pediatric immunologist at UCSF, identified a case of a child, a young girl who was transfused with platelets at birth, and shortly thereafter, within a couple of years, developed what looked like AIDS at a time when no one really thought of this as potentially even affecting children. But he saw this, and the blood bank tracked down the donors of that blood and found that one of the donors had recently died of AIDS. And it was that case, to my memory, that really said this is an infectious disease. And furthermore, that it's being transmitted by blood, which means, because we're very careful about screening blood for most pathogens, that this must be a virus. A virus would be the only thing that would likely escape that kind of screening. And so we suspected that we were dealing with a new virus without knowing how to test for it, without knowing how it was transmitted, without knowing what the incubation period. And so it was that experience that made us really concerned. And until somewhat later, as we thought about this issue of taking care of patients with the new virus, we hadn't done anything in particular. We weren't worried about our own risk. So we didn't think about masking. We didn't think about using gloves. And, you know, we didn't use gloves even for doing arterial sticks, because we thought we needed the sensitivity of our fingertip to feel the pulse under the needle, putting a needle, you know, within millimeters of our own skin into an artery with blood under pressure, which we now recognize as a very risky procedure. At the time, we thought we could not possibly use gloves to do that. We went to our dentists, and our dentists didn't use gloves when they examined and worked in our mouths. Dentists never wore gloves in those days. And so over time, as we knew the enemy that we were dealing with, we did adopt what are called body substance precautions, which now, you know, everyone just assumes were always present, but at the time they weren't.
Thank you for sharing and explaining that to us, because we really do have to wrap our heads around that. That's a very big concept historically, and it isn't that long ago, but it, like you said, it seems like it's been forever that everybody wears gloves. Once it was more clear, this is a virus, this could be communicable, we could get infected too. That sounds like is when it became an especially scary time to be working with AIDS patients during the early 8 days of the pandemic. And I think that's a question Nicole and I were wondering about. I think it took courage. I mean, I think everyone would say it took courage to go ahead and still work when it currently does also with COVID and any Ebola and any pandemic or epidemic, to put yourself at risk now that you know that you are. And certainly those who did work with patients did use a lot of courage. I'm wondering if there were people that you knew who didn't want to, were too afraid to work, that it was just too risky for them to work with the HIV population. Could you talk a little bit about your experience with that?
It's an important and complicated issue. And when we think about even the recent experience we've had with COVID, we can remember, because it was only a couple of years ago, that there was a period where we didn't know, and we were leaving our mail at the front door, we were washing our fruit, none of those things that made any sense. And what we quickly learned was how that virus was spread. And so we were really in the dark with HIV. There's a lot of reason to be fearful. And some people, as you suggested, some people said, I just can't handle that degree of personal risk, and I'll choose not to be involved. I think there wasn't so much the fact that people were involved and then left because they're afraid. I think a number of physicians just didn't get involved, including a number of infectious disease physicians. You know, they hadn't chosen their specialty because they were courageous. They chose it because they were interested in infections, and they didn't want to take the risk of this. And I understand that. We were a little bit critical at some points because the numbers got so bad that we felt that we needed every hand on deck. But other physicians, you know, Connie Wofsy, who is my co-founder of Ward 86, her husband David remembers her as not being particularly afraid. More power to her. I was afraid, but it did feel to me and to really the vast majority of people who became involved in caring for AIDS patients that these patients were so sick, there was no question that they needed our help, what little help we could provide, because at first we couldn't do very much, but they needed us. And that's why we went into medicine. And I think clearly historically, physicians, including during the plagues, those that didn't escape London during the Great Plague stayed and worked, and in many cases got infected and died because of that. Physicians have chosen to work with tuberculosis at a time when tuberculosis was transmissible and non-treatable. So what we were going through wasn't unique to medicine. We had, I think, as a profession, gotten to the point where we had convinced ourselves and maybe the public that there was no longer a risk, but that's not the historic truth of medicine. So we were doing what good physicians had always done, which is to say, yes, there's a risk. I understand there is a risk, but I have to do what I do. And very, very few people left this field.
I love that look back into history. And I think history does tend to repeat itself. I can imagine not only the fear of getting the virus yourself, but also the fact that a large population of HIV patients that you're working with, a lot of them were young, if not similar ages to the physicians and nursing staff that were taking care of them. And additionally, a lot of these populations, especially in the beginning, were made up of patients who identified as gay men and people who identified as using IV drugs. Can you share how it felt and what it was like to work with this population that is often stigmatized, and how the SF and broader community responded to the epidemic of these people?
Really important issue. Our epidemic in San Francisco was at first almost exclusively in gay men. There were probably early on a few injection drug users, but really until quite a bit later, almost none. There were occasional women, but almost none. So this was a very restricted population. And we can talk more about what all that meant. But one of the things that it meant was that we could identify the community with whom we needed to work. It was clear that we had to work with the gay community to respond to this epidemic, and that the politicians had a community watching them, again, the gay community, and helped, I think, them decide to remain committed to this effort. I know from talking to my colleagues, Jerry Friedland, for example, in the Bronx, who was taking care of a population that was almost all minoritized men and women, whose risk was mostly injection drug use and heterosexual transmission, for whom there was really very little a sense of community and political support. As challenging as it was here in San Francisco, I think we really were very favored by the situation that we had in the early epidemic. It's true, though, that the patient population even here was a very stigmatized one in many quarters. Very many people, including many of the families of our patients, had really nothing positive to say about the gay community. And so we had to understand that. We didn't like hearing about that, but we understood it. We really had to work with the gay community, and I think we developed a relationship that was hugely important and really became fundamentally part of our community response.
The community connection, I think, might have been complicated in the beginning. I would love for you to share that, because there was so much unknown and so much fear. I remember from that wonderful documentary that I think you created or co-created, that's called Life Before the Lifeboat, in 2011, roughly. I remember one of the early nurses who was caring for patients on the wards at San Francisco General shared something like, a lot of families were getting a phone call to hear that their son is dying and their son has terrible cancer and the son has this terrible virus that we have no treatment for, and he's gay, all in one conversation, which is a lot for anyone to take. And I think that created a sense of, honestly, devastation among family members and a lot of fear, because in the community, the point that there was no treatment for it, it's pretty overwhelmingly devastating. And if you were a member of the gay community, you were watching your friends, the people that you cared about and loved in your community, dying. It's really difficult to wrap your head around or really wrap your heart around everything that was going on. So it doesn't do justice to say any words, although I would like to put a plug for this really beautiful documentary, Life Before the Lifeboat, that you helped put together, Dr. Volberding, for all of our listeners. It's available for free on YouTube, and it's only about 30 minutes long, but I think it really does a wonderful job of highlighting the various clinicians and people that were involved in the very early days. And I think bringing the heart experience of those individuals is really profound.
Thanks. Let me just say that I'd been invited to give a lecture on the early history of the epidemic. And I thought, you know, I can tell my stories, but I wanted other people to have voices. And so I invited a number of people to talk to me about their experience. As you say, it was a very important and great document.
And thank you for doing it. Could you talk to us a little bit about the story of how Ward 86 for the outpatient clinic for HIV patients and how Ward 5B, which was the new inpatient unit for HIV patients, could you tell us the story about how those got started?
I love telling the story of both of them. My heart is really kind of more Ward 86, but let's do a quick story. So when I started at the hospital, I was the first oncologist there in 1981, and we decided to have the oncology clinic take place in 5B, Ward 5B, and we used for exam tables the beds that the interns and residents use for sleeping at night. So our exam tables became the beds. And when in 82 and 83, it became clear that this was an infectious disease, and we all knew that many of our patients had various infections, one of the medicine residents who was pregnant in 1983 asked the hospital whether we knew it was safe for her to sleep in the same beds that were being used for exam tables for AIDS patients. And of course, no one knew that it was safe. We didn't know it was safe. And so the hospital very, very quickly realized they had a crisis and found us empty space in one of the old red brick buildings, building 80 on the sixth floor. The whole floor was vacant. It had been used as an alcohol detox program at one point, and we were given one half of the floor, the south half of the floor. The north half had one activity, had a jazzercise class during the afternoon for hospital staff. And so that was Ward 86. That's how we started. It was a couple of us docs and one clerk and a nurse, Gailing G. And that was the nucleus of this. And really, I think it's important that right from the start, it was multidisciplinary. I was there as an oncologist. Connie Wasti was there as an infectious disease person. And so that philosophy of providing kind of comprehensive care really became the core of Ward 86. Ward 5B then took over our space that we had vacated for the oncology clinic and took over that space on Ward 5B for the AIDS inpatients, opening in the middle of 1983. And that was a very important unit, taking care of the sickest and literally dying patients in a unit that was really organized and staffed very proudly by the nurses of San Francisco General Hospital. It was an idea of the nurses. The nurses approached the hospital. Docs were involved in helping design it, but really it was the nurses that did it. And the philosophy of Ward 5B really from the very start was an amazing reflection on the nursing profession, because the way the patients approached, the compassion, the love that the patients experienced on that ward. Docs are good, but nurses are better when it comes to a lot of things. And the nurses really took proud ownership of that as long as we needed it. You know, as the epidemic changed, we no longer did, but it was a very important part of our overall effort.
That is so incredible. And as you mentioned, it sounds like, you know, with Ward 5B, you're often taking care of some of the sickest patients in the hospital. And many of these patients were in their 20s, 30s, pretty young to be on their deathbed. I'd love to hear how you and your colleagues coped with this immense grief. And as we know from working in the pandemic of COVID, oftentimes working in a, you know, day to day with so much grief, so much, you know, death and sadness can often lead to burnout. Did you ever experience burnout?
Well, the patients were young, no question. They were our age. And, you know, now as a father of one of my children just turned 42 today, born during the epidemic or just before the epidemic, and you realize that it's not appropriate for parents to see their children die. It's just not. You know, children should watch their parents die. Yet these patients were the same age as the doctors and many of the nurses. And watching the families cope with this unexpected, horrible loss was really a shock. And the stress on everyone involved was enormous. Did we have burnout? Yeah. Did we call it burnout? Not so much at the time. I think the term hadn't really been popularized, but we were under stress. And I remember a time on Ward 86 when the staff was just kind of on each other's case. Snapping and anger and just didn't make sense because we were all good, loving healthcare providers, and it was clearly burnout. No one that I recall left the work, but we brought in help to help us deal with it. We brought in counselors to help us understand what we were facing, and it really did help. But we needed that sort of healing. The group was a part of a project called the Center for Attitudinal Healing. And we needed it and we received it, and it was hugely important for us.
It's difficult to even imagine, but there are some parallels with the COVID and the early days of COVID. And I'm having images of New York City and all the bodies that they couldn't even contain, and there weren't ventilators. Certainly different experiences, but that intensity of being face to face with death and dying in not peaceful ways. I mean, really very painful and miserably difficult ways and often alone, but that the staff, as you said, doctors are good and nurses are better and social workers are probably also even better. I could really only imagine that there would be times where therapy and healing is necessary, but it was probably the love that kept you going.
One of the things that I wouldn't say angers me, but you know, the public often sees death in movies and on television as this moment of peaceful transition, you know, people quietly die and their eyes close and everyone feels sad. Death in real life is often very, very unattractive, especially young people struggle to stay alive, even when everyone around them knows that it's time to go. And we had the chance to see that just over and over again. The horrible, the end of life, which it always felt important, but it rarely felt beautiful and peaceful. It was a real amazing thing. The people think of COVID as causing, you know, lots of death, and it did. But everyone infected with HIV, until we had treatment, everyone infected with HIV died of the disease, 100% or nearly 100%. So this was something that if you're a gay man in San Francisco and you were healthy but diagnosed with this virus, even if you felt healthy, you knew you were dead. You knew you were facing your own death. And so it really just added to the enormous community pressure that we felt in responding to this.
I was a medical student learning phlebotomy during the early days of HIV, and we had just begun using gloves. And I remember very well, I was at the VA, and I had just drawn blood from a patient who looked very emaciated. He didn't look well, but I had just successfully drawn blood. It was one of my first patients. And there was a student who was observing who saw me struggling with the needle. And everything happened so quickly, but she came over. I don't know how it came to be, but she tried to help me. And the needle flipped and poked me into my finger, and I bled. And I stayed calm and I went to wash my finger very quickly and I sort of bled it out to make sure. I knew that's not good to get a needle stick injury, but it's okay. And then when I came back after washing out and kind of praying, I hope this is okay, I went back to the patient and I said, I'm so sorry, you know, we're fine. I think we've got everything. And he looked at me and said, are you okay? And I said, yes, I think I just got a little needle stick injury. It was actually a significant injury. I bled a lot. And then I said to him, you don't have HIV, do you? And he looked at me, he was very pale and very unwell. And he said, I have end stage AIDS. And I knew very instantly that I probably had the virus in my finger because the viral load, we were early learning about viral load, was probably very high per drop of blood. And honestly, my life kind of ended in my mind. I really thought I was in my early 20s or mid 20s. And I really thought, I guess I'm not going to live very long. I guess I won't have the things happen in my life that I thought would happen. Because at that time, Dr. Bulberding, as you said, it was pretty universally fatal. This was not something anybody would wish upon anybody else.
I was going to say we had a family experience of that too. Molly, when I was seeing patients on Ward 86, I was asked to do a spinal, an LP on a patient, and I was really busy monitoring and kind of supervising the clinic, and she agreed to do it for me, did it, and got a nick with a spinal needle, which is, as you know, a very large gauge needle. And at the time, we didn't know that the virus was actually in the spinal fluid, in some cases in really high concentrations, but we knew enough to be worried. And so it was before the test was available. So for months, we lived with the fear that, you know, by having our own personal contacts with each other, that we were possibly infected and becoming infected. So that fear was something that I really relate to what you're saying, because it's something that we've all had.
Yeah, you just live with that fear. There's nothing you can do about it except wait and hope and pray. And it's just amazing how far we've come, because it was a dream at that time that I hope someday there will be, you know, a cure for HIV. Dr. Bulberding, thank you for sharing the personal experience. Could you talk a little bit about how the San Francisco community, the gay community in particular, and the community at large, how the community played a role for caring for people with HIV, and also about advocacy and how effective it was in leading to more research and testing and ultimately treatment?
It's another hour question that you're tossing to me.
We're going to have you back for several more conversations.
I'm happy to. We need to do this again. So right from the very first, I've learned to be careful about how I say what I say, but I was used to, as a young oncologist, of taking care of people with limited financial resources, often recent immigrants, often speaking English, if at all, as a second language. So lots of social issues around patients with cancer. But there was almost always, I'm going to put air quotes now, a family to help in the outpatient care. You know, most patients with serious illness spend most of their time at home, not in the hospital. And there was often a family to help take care of the issues, do the shopping, do the cooking, do, you know, bringing the person back and forth to the medical center, taking care of the kids, cleaning the house, all those things that have to be done whether you're sick or not. And with our very first AIDS patients, really none of that happened, because the patients were often, they had no family as most of us understood it. Certainly nothing like a traditional father and mother and the rest. And often they were off quite isolated young men. So right from the first, we realized we're going to take care of these patients. We have to find some way to take care of them when they're not in the hospital. And we turned to the gay community, and the response was immediate. And many organizations, including some of the political organizations, the Alice B. Toklas and the Harvey Milk Club, they were part of the response. Organizations like Shanti that had been around before the AIDS epidemic quickly pivoted to take care of some of the needs that we were seeing. Other organizations like Project Open Hand to provide food decided to do that very quickly. And so quickly we found that we had a number of supports in the gay community, and really important. Housing was provided, legal referrals were provided, emergency financial aid was provided. Bereavement support was provided. And so that became really as important and as significant a part of, you know, the San Francisco response, the model of care, as Ward 86 itself did. It was all so necessary. And the response was so overwhelming and positive, and supported by the politicians and the health authorities as well. So this was a really important story for how a community like San Francisco could respond to what was otherwise just a horrendous situation.
It truly takes a village. I don't think that could be more true. And it's really an honor to practice medicine in a city with such a rich and powerful history. So I appreciate you sharing that. I'd love to know really what it was like back in the day when AZT first came out, AZT being the first effective treatment for HIV, and that came out in 1987. What was that like for you?
Well, to say that it was an effective treatment would have generated a lot of argument back in the day, because AZT was the way we were using it at first. It was not very potent, and it was really inconvenient and really toxic. So here was the first drug, but it had to be taken every 4 hours. And for a lot of patients, every 4 hours around the clock, if you can imagine setting your alarm clock at night to wake you up in the middle of your sleep to take a pill that would make you have what we now call brain fog, that would cause headaches, nausea, all for a very partial response in your infection. It didn't make people feel better. It helped them stay alive a bit longer. It was hugely important because it was evidence that a medicine could treat a chronic viral infection, which to that point had never been seen in medicine. So it was a horrible virus. People were desperate for hope, and AZT for some people did represent hope. For other people, it represented a real controversy. Was this doing anything? Some people that we encountered felt that we were guilty of genocide, that we were foisting this horrible toxin on these poor dying people. And so it was very controversial from the start. And, you know, some of us were accused of practicing Nazi medicine for prescribing AZT. But it was the first step. And with further use and clinical research, we realized that we didn't need to use such high doses. It could be taken as infrequently as twice a day instead of six times a day. So we made efforts to make it less toxic and more convenient. But it was a number of years later that we realized, by adding other drugs in the same general family as AZT to that drug, that we could then really see the dramatic change that we saw in 1995.
I was just thinking how I actually did go on AZT when I had my needle stick injury. AZT had just come out fairly recently, and I was on it for prevention. I think it was five times a day, and I didn't feel very well. And as I said, thankfully, it turned out well with testing afterwards, and I remained negative. But I remember the experience of the toxicities. I wanted to ask you, we've talked about this a little bit, but when you think about your career and how it's changed personally for you, your practice of medicine and your career path, can you talk to us a little bit about how your journey was and how it changed because of HIV, both your practice of medicine personally and your career?
Well, it changed about as dramatically as one could see a career change, I think. I initially was interested in lab science. I wanted to be a basic researcher. I did oncology really as a way to study viruses, because I fell in love with viruses when I was in college. And it was only as I got more experience taking care of cancer patients that I decided that that was actually more central to me than the science. And so I left the lab to take care of cancer patients. And then when the AIDS epidemic happened, I ended up realizing that the virus that was causing AIDS was the same kind of virus that I had worked at when I was in the lab. So suddenly I was back with retroviruses, and shifted my attention really from cancer specifically to this virus, so that the rest of my career was really much more central to me to think about this virus and to help develop new drugs for it. So, you know, I went from the lab to the clinic and kind of back to the virus, but always in my career with patient central. I never went really back into the lab, but it did change dramatically. When I go to oncology meetings, no one knows me. When I go to infectious disease meetings, I'm well known. So it changed my specialty without ever training in infectious disease. I tell people to always be prepared to shift your career as events change.
That is amazing. I love how, as we look back at the HIV epidemic, I think it's also important to look at where HIV, the epidemic, is today. and what is the status? And so according to the WHO, nearly a million people today still die every year from the virus. Some of these patients don't know they have HIV and are not on treatment, or they just don't have access to treatment, or they sometimes start treatment too late. This is despite the WHO recommendation guidelines in 2015 that recommends that all people with HIV who are living with the virus should receive antiretroviral treatment because it is so effective, regardless of their immune status and stage of the infection, and to get started on this medication as soon as they are diagnosed, as soon as possible.
Right. And according to the WHO, the same article, in 2017, almost 2 million, 1.8 million people were newly infected with HIV. And while the world has committed to ending AIDS by 2030, we're already at 2023, but by 2030, the rates of infections and deaths are not falling rapidly enough to meet that target.
And honestly, as we discussed earlier, I think one of the biggest challenges in the HIV response that has remained unchanged over the last 30 years is HIV disproportionately affects people in vulnerable populations that are often highly stigmatized and marginalized. Thus, most new HIV infections and deaths are seen in places where certain higher risk groups remain unaware, underserved, and neglected. About 75% of new HIV infections outside sub-Saharan Africa are in men who have sex with men, people who inject drugs, people in prisons, people who trade sex for money, or transgender folks, or those who have sexual partners with these individuals. These are groups that are often discriminated against and excluded from health services.
Dr. Volberding, you are a leader in global health and in HIV care, of course. Could you tell us about what you see as the future of HIV globally and how we can ultimately find a way to reaching our goal of ending AIDS by, who knows, by 2030?
Right. I think it's at some points we look at those predictions, you know, ending by this date or that date, and our eyes cross a little bit. But I think it is important, actually, to set a goal. I think 2030 is looking like a very ambitious goal for ending the AIDS epidemic. It's much more likely that this is a chronic virus that's going to be with humans forever. But fortunately, we have some amazing tools, you know, as we've been talking about, the treatments that we have now, which are often in the form of one pill containing several medicines that can be taken once a day with no side effects, or even long-term injection treatments that might be taken every 6 months, are able to essentially block the growth of the virus and allow the person to remain healthy and to regain health and live a normal lifespan. So we can do an amazing, and the other aspect of that is the treatment of an infected person means that that person will no longer transmit the virus. So if your needle stick injury happened with a person who is on effective anti-HIV treatments, you weren't really at any risk for infection. And that's a hugely important story. And then finally, a simple treatment like one pill once a day or an injection very infrequently might completely prevent you from acquiring this infection, the so-called PrEP. So we have the medical tools. We need the political courage and commitment to make sure that people in most need have access to those tools. You know, if I'm pessimistic, it's that we seem to be so willing to have a healthcare system in our country and across the world that's so poorly organized and unfairly delivered that people keep dying of very, very treatable, preventable conditions. So we have the tools, but the real barrier, I think, is going to be the willingness of our leaders and us to commit to making this happen.
I definitely appreciate that. And I do feel like our healthcare system in the United States and globally is very much reactionary rather than proactive. And, you know, I do hope that sometime in the hopefully very close future, we shift our thinking and really start to be proactive. And looking back at really the last 40 years, I'd love to hear some of the highlights of the major lessons that you learned treating the HIV epidemic.
So many lessons. And COVID has taught us again, if we didn't learn it from HIV, that we should always be prepared for the next pandemic. There will be other infections that we encounter as a society, and we should be doing what we can to remember the lessons from one pandemic to the next. So I think that's really important, investing in the science. The importance in the AIDS epidemic of developing the tests to allow us to know who was infected, how the virus was transmitted. But I think the most important one is to, again, think of our overall community of response and to realize that none of us are in this alone, that we must work in a community of responders, and that that includes the people that are most directly affected by the health condition that we're facing, in this case, HIV. That was a really important lesson and one that I really do hope that we haven't forgotten. And we look for ways like this podcast to remind people that that is worth remembering as we face our future.
And lastly, as we're getting close to ending this beautiful time with you and closing this podcast session, we would love to have you back for another. Could you help us close this session by sharing any advice that you have for students or trainees who are interested in HIV and advocacy and community work as well?
Certainly. I think HIV, you can think of it as last year's epidemic, right? But it's not. It's still here. It's still a challenge. And I think it still reveals so many of the fault lines in our society that medicine tries to respond to. The problem of marginalized populations, the problem of people who haven't been fully informed about the nature of their own risk and how to help respond to that. So I think that the challenge is there. I think the rewards of responding to this, one, understand, again, the nature of the community in which we work, the fact that this is a truly a global community, that no problem is isolated to San Francisco or California or the United States. Everything we encounter really has to be seen as part of a global context. And I think, you know, medicine remains an amazing area to work because it allows us to work with that knowledge. There's so many pathways that we explore and ones that will help us respond not just to this epidemic, but to the next ones as well.
Thank you so much for sharing all of your wisdom. Honestly, your passion, your courage in medicine is truly inspiring, and we really appreciate you coming on the podcast today.
Thank you, Dr. Wolverding. And just wanted to remind our audience, if anybody is interested to learn more about Dr. Wolverding and his amazing colleagues with whom he worked in those early days, he helped create a short documentary that is called Life Before the Lifeboat. And it's only about 30 minutes long. It's probably among the best 30 minutes you'll ever spend. And it's available for free on YouTube. So we welcome our audience to check it out and learn more. Thank you again, Dr. Wolverding, for your time and your wisdom.
Happy to be here. Delighted to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in today
and allowing us to be one of your meaningful moments.
Please rate, review, and subscribe, and share with friends, family, and colleagues. Meaningful Medicine was produced by Shiva Kayambashi, Nicole Hohenstein, David Elkin, Nikki Elkin, Ahaley Chattopadhyay, and Leigh Kodama. Editing by Nicole Hohenstein, Nikki Elkin, and Leigh Kodama. Intro and closing by Daniel Wendling. On Meaningful Medicine, we are careful to ensure that all stories are compliant with healthcare privacy laws, and details may have been changed to ensure patient confidentiality. All views expressed are of the person speaking and not their employer.